This episode of the Disney Nerds Podcast is brought to you by TouringPlans.com. Spend less time in line and more time riding your favorite attractions. Visit TouringPlans.com.
Welcome to the splendor, the spectacle, the sparkling sensation, where the romance, the comedy, and the thrill of Disney fantasies come to electric life.
And as our friend Jiminy said, welcome. Welcome to the Disney Nerds Podcast, a place each week where like-minded people get together to discuss all things Disney. We'll help you get your Disney fix on. Here we go.
The Magic Kingdom proudly presents, in a million points of musical light, the Magic Worlds of Disney.
Hello and welcome to show number 225 of the Disney Nerds Podcast. Hey guys, how's it going? And welcome back to the show. On this week's show, we're going to bring you a different type of show. One of the things we always talk about is that Walt Disney World, Disneyland, the entire Disney company was really started by one man, Walter Elias Disney. And sometimes we lose sight of that fact. So what we're going to do is every so often we're going to throw a show like this into the mix where we're going to go to the man himself. We're going to listen to what Walt said in the many interviews, in the many shows, and basically in just anything that's out there recorded. What we're going to do is hopefully see some of the insights in why he made the decisions he made, maybe see some of the goals he had, and hopefully see some of the things that made up the man who was Walter Elias Disney. So the first clip we have tonight is a pretty easy place to start. We're going to hear Walt talking about Mickey Mouse. Now, when you listen to this recording, and I kind of thought it myself too, it kind of doesn't sound like Walt, but it is. He must have been really set up. He must have been doing this for a radio show or something. But when he laughs, he actually kind of makes a couple mistakes, and he does list through his movie accomplishments, and you can hear him chuckle, laugh around that, and once he does that, you know exactly it's Walt Disney. Some of the things to listen for in this one, it's pretty cool because he talks about Mickey's character arc, about why he stays the way he is, why he's such a great guy. He talks about the state of the studio in 1948, because that's when this took place. It's Mickey's 20th birthday. And the thing that also kind of stuck out, when I listen to old recordings like this, when I see movies from the 20s, 30s, 40s and such, I love to see things or hear things that took place then. Walt makes a mention about when the recording for one of the synchronized, I think it was Steamboat Willie, that one of the instruments was blowing out the recording lamps. And when he said lamps, that didn't make any sense because of our world, but I think he might have been referring to tubes, perhaps, in the equipment they were using, which is interesting to hear those type of things because in the day, that was normal. For us, that just sounds out of this world. So anyway, here's Walt talking about his prodigy, talking about Mickey Mouse.
Mickey Mouse, to me, is a symbol of independence. He was a means to an end. He popped out of my mind onto a drawing pad 20 years ago on a train ride from Manhattan to Hollywood at a time when the business fortunes of my brother Roy and myself were at lowest ebb and disaster seemed right around the corner. Born of necessity, the little fellow literally freed us of immediate worry. He spelled production liberation for us. His first actual screen appearance was at the Old Colony Theater in New York in Steamboat Willie, with its sound effects and cautious speech. His current appearance is in our new musical fantasy feature in Technicolor, combining living and animated action, fun and fancy-free. In between, he has appeared in more pictures than any flesh and blood star. He was the first cartoon character to stress personality and to be constantly kept in character. I thought of him from the first as a distinct individual, not just a cartoon type or symbol going through comedy routines. I kept him away from stock symbols and situations. We exposed him in close-ups. Instead of speeding the cartoons, as was then the fashion, we were not afraid to slow down the tempo and let Mickey emote. We allowed audiences to get acquainted with him, to recognize him as a personage, motivated by character instead of situations. Quite consciously, I had been preparing Mickey and his screen pals for the advent of sound. I'd made quite a few silent pictures prior to Steamboat Willie. It may seem a curious thing that even in those early films, with their explanatory balloons, I had thought of them in terms of sound and speech and dreamed of the day when the voice would be synchronized with the silent action. But I felt sure it was coming. Our tempo and rhythm and general animation technique were already being adjusted so that sound could fit in readily when it came. As early as 1923, I was doing song films. I seldom thought of our silent product without some musical complement. I used to talk to the organist in the theater on arrangements before a film was shown. I even had a gadget which ensured a crude kind of synchronization between the organ music and the picture action. In 1925, I had an animated cat in one of our silents direct the orchestra in the pit from the screen. While this was all preliminary to sound in films, it was preparatory background and equipment for that first Mickey Mouse talker and the subsequent swift evolvement of sound. Of course, sound had a very considerable effect on our treatment of Mickey Mouse. It gave his character a new dimension. It rounded him into complete lifelikeness, and it carried us into a new phase of his development. Mickey had reached the stage where we had to be very careful about what we permitted him to do. He'd become a hero in the eyes of his audiences, especially the youngsters. Mickey could do no wrong. I could never attribute any meanness or callous traits to him. We kept him lovable, although ludicrous in his blundering heroics. And that's the way he's remained, despite any outside influences. He's grown into a consistent, predictable character to whom we could assign only the kind of role and antic which were correct for his reputation. Naturally, I'm pleased with his continued popularity here and abroad, with the esteem he has won as an entertainment name among youngsters and grown-ups, with the honors he's brought our studio, with the high compliment bestowed when his name was the password for the invasion of France, and with his selection for insignia by scores of fighting units during the war years. These are tributes beyond all words of appreciation. In a business way, as I've indicated, Mickey meant almost incalculable things to my brother Roy and to me as we went through our ups and downs toward founding our present organization with its Burbank studio, its extensive personnel, and its continuous picture schedules. At this turning point in our career, already referred to, I needed just such a fresh cartoon personality to sell a projected series of short subjects, which, after failing to get over my ideas with another cartoon venture in New York, I proposed a new series. I felt I had to rely on a sustained character appeal rather than on the merit of each separate issue. Mickey fitted the need exactly. He brought in the money which saved the day. He paved the way for our more elaborate screen ventures. He enabled us to explore our medium and to evolve the technical advances which were to appear in our first feature-length animation fantasy, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, and successively in other features like Bambi, Dumbo, Pinocchio, Fantasia, The Three Caballeros, Saludos Amigos, Victory Through Air Power, Make Mine Music, Song of the South, and so up to our latest and current production, Fun and Fancy Free. In his immediate and continuously successful appeal to all kinds of audiences, Mickey first subsidized our first Silly Symphony series. From there, he sustained other ventures, plugging along as our bread and butter hero. He was a studio prodigy and pet, and we treated him accordingly. In due time, we gave Mickey that contrasting, temperamental sidekick, Donald Duck. Then Pluto, the naive, credulous hound, came along. We used to play these three together in the same picture. Later, we divided them into separate vehicles, Mickey, Donald, and Pluto. These meant fewer pictures for each, and of course, Mickey appeared less often. But you'll see him again in his most hair-raising adventure in Mickey and the Beanstalk, an escapade from Fun and Fancy Free. Prior to this, his top performance was in Fantasia as a Sorcerer's Apprentice. In the early days, I did the voice of most of our characters. It wasn't financially feasible to hire people for such assignments. In Steamboat Willie, in addition to speaking for Mickey, I also supplied a few sound effects for Minnie, his girlfriend, and for the parrot. For Mickey's first picture, I had planned to go all out on sound, and those plans came very near spelling a major disaster for us. To launch our picture impressively, I had hired a full New York orchestra with a famous director to do the recording. The musicians were to cost $10 an hour. I thought 15 men would be enough, but the director insisted on having 30 men. Because I was awed by him, I was finally persuaded to take the 30. The upshot was that I had to borrow on my automobile, and Roy and I had to mortgage our homes as well to cover the cost of that first synchronization for Steamboat Willie. And when it was finished, the picture wouldn't synchronize with the sound, and we had to do it all over after the orchestra leader had reluctantly consented to follow the mechanics that we had prepared at the studio. What I wanted most of all, I didn't get: a bull fiddle for the bass. The recording room was so small that the orchestra could hardly be jammed into it. The bull fiddle blasted so loud it ruined the other sound and kept blowing out all of the recording lamps. A sad thing, I thought at the time, to launch our Mickey without benefit of bull fiddle in so precarious a world of new possibilities and increased competition. But he survived and thrived and set the pace in his entertainment field. The cost of his first vehicles ranged from the bare $1,200 for Steamboat Willie to seven figures for Fun and Fancy Free, in which he shares prominence with Donald, Goofy, Jiminy Cricket, and several new cartoon creations, and with Edgar Bergen and his radio pals Charlie McCarthy, Mortimer Snurd, and also Dinah Shore and our own little starlet, Luana Patton. I often find myself surprised at what has been said about our redoubtable little Mickey, who was never really a mouse, nor yet wholly a man, although always recognizably human, I hope. Psychoanalysis have probed him. Wise men of critical inclination have pondered him. Columnists have kidded him. Admirers have suited him in extravagant terms. The League of Nations gave him a special medal as a symbol of international goodwill. Hitler was infuriated by him and thunderingly forbade his people to wear the then-popular Mickey Mouse lapel button in place of the swastika. The little fellow's grin was too infectious for Nazism. But all we ever intended for him and expected of him was that he should continue to make people everywhere chuckle with him and at him. We didn't burden him with any social symbolism. We made him no mouthpiece for frustrations or harsh satire. Mickey was simply a little personality assigned to the purposes of laughter. And it is certainly gratifying that the public, which first welcomed him two decades ago, as well as their children, have not permitted us, even if we had wished so to do, to change him in any manner or degree other than a few minor revisions of his physical appearance. In a sense, he was never young. In the same sense, he never grows old in our eyes. All we can do is give him things to overcome in his own rather stubborn way in his cartoon universe. There's much nostalgia for me in these reflections. The life and ventures of Mickey Mouse have been closely bound up with my own personal and professional life. It is understandable that I should have sentimental attachment for the little personage who played so big a part in the course of Disney productions and has been so happily accepted as an amusing friend wherever films are shown around the world. He still speaks for me, and I still speak for him. Mickey, I think on this occasion you should say something to all our friends who are listening around the world.
Okay. Well, happy birthday, everybody.
No, Mickey, you don't understand. It's your birthday. This is your 20th birthday.
Oh, gosh. Well, I'll be seeing you.
That was a great start. As you listen to these different clips, keep in mind he was either giving interviews or trying to basically run up business. So you'll hear a bit of advertising whenever you hear Walt talk, and it was just the name of the game at the time. Even today, you'll still hear the same thing. An executive goes on TV to talk about his company, he's going to definitely push a little bit of what about what they sell and things. The next clip is an interview of Walt as soon as he got off the plane, it sounds like. This is right before The Great Locomotive Chase, which was a live-action movie in 1955. So you're going to hear him talk a little bit about that. You're going to hear him talk a little bit about projects coming up. And just in general, a pretty interesting conversation. Here you go.
Well, the famous Walt Disney arrived in town today at Idlewild Airport. And we sent a man out to interview him, Mr. Don Goddard. And Mr. Disney had some interesting things to say about his ABC television series and his future films, which we thought you would like to hear about here on The Hideaway. And right now, let's switch on over to Don Goddard talking to Mr. Walt Disney.
I'm Don Goddard of ABC.
But Walt, what brings you here?
Well, I've come back. Let's see, there's several things. We're doing a little closed circuit, you know, on the Mickey Mouse Club show that's going out Friday.
Yeah.
And then Saturday I go down to Tullytown, and they're opening a new school down there that the children have honored, named in my honor. They call it the Walt Disney Elementary School, which
oh,
is
wonderful.
Quite a thing. And then from New York I go to Atlanta, and we're starting a new picture.
Oh, you're cooking up something new for us, are you?
It's a feature film with Fess Parker and Jeff Hunter and a bunch of big, tall men. The Great Locomotive Chase, story of a bunch of Yankee spies who go down into Southern Territory and steal a locomotive.
Yes.
But the Southerners overtake them and everything. And
this is
it's
a true
good story,
isn't it?
True story, yes.
Yeah. And Fess Parker doesn't do a Davy Crockett this time.
Huh? No, no, we got him out of Buckskin. Yeah.
Well, the kids of Tullytown brought you back to us from Disneyland. Now, tell us what you're cooking up for the future about this Great Locomotive Chase.
Well, it'll be an exciting adventure story in super-duper CinemaScope and Technicolor.
Yeah.
And,
the usual fantasy.
No, no, this is a true story.
This is
a
true story.
Yes, it is. In fact, the survivors of this expedition were the first to receive the Congressional Medal of Honor.
Oh, I see, yeah.
First six.
Good piece of history, then.
Yes, it's all history.
And then what other corners of Disneyland are we going to see in the future?
I mean on the television show. Oh, yes, we're going to the moon this year.
You are?
Uh-huh. And it's in work now. It'll be out in December.
And, it'll be interesting to see if about 50 years from now how accurate you people were, you know.
Well, it's not me. We're just doing the drawings. I have scientists working on it with me, you see. And this year, a new addition to my staff is a nuclear physicist.
Uh-huh. Well, then
I've had PhDs and a lot of other scientists there, but this new one is a nuclear physicist.
Well, you're going to call this the Disney University after a while, aren't you?
Well, we're going to do a story of the atom.
Yes.
We're working on it now. And I want to go into a lot of things that pertain to the future.
Yes.
See, this this era that we're living in is an exciting one, and I think it's worth trying to explain and picture for the...
Well, you're helping making it more exciting, too, for the kids. Those kids are going to the Disney School, for example. You're making it pleasant for them to go to school.
Well,
and teaching them while you entertain,
yeah,
too.
The kids name the school, you know.
Yes, I understand. Incidentally, do you like kids?
Well, I must. I don't know.
You certainly must. Well, my kids grew up with your stuff. Do you think that the Disney technique lends itself more for children or for grown-ups, or is it a combination of the two things?
Well, we don't play down, or we don't try to play over the heads of anyone. I mean, we just sort of, as I say, we just lay it straight out on the table and...
Yeah.
In a way that we hope will have a broad appeal, you see. Our big audience, you know, is the adult, too. I mean, it's very important in our enterprises.
Well, you've been
after all, they have the money. The kids don't have any money, you see.
That's right. You can't get into movies on pins, that's for sure. Well, you're one of these men who likes his work, too, aren't you, Walt?
Well, I guess I must. I seem to enjoy it more than maybe wandering off on a vacation.
Well,
a change of troubles is usually a vacation for me.
Is that right?
Yeah.
That's your avocation as well as your vocation, then.
Yeah.
Well, what's your greatest satisfaction in life, by the way?
Oh, the whole thing, I think. Being able to do what I wanted to do all my life and have it enjoyed and appreciated the way it is by people.
And it's come out just the way you thought it would?
No, I never thought about it in this way. I don't know. It was one of those things you just went ahead and one thing led to another.
Yeah.
And I never had any dreams of anything like this. I just, well, you always hope. Everybody hopes.
Sure.
But it wasn't, I didn't have any real plan. I just started, and this is where it ended up so far.
Well,
I can still go broke again, though. I've been broke two or three times.
Well, you seem to take it very well, though, in any case.
Well, you can't go any worse than broke. That's where I started.
Well, we're enjoying every minute of it, and thanks a lot, Walt, for being with us.
You bet.
All right.
Goodbye.
Good luck.
Two things about that last clip. First, Fess Parker seems to be already stereotyped as Davy Crockett. The other thing that kind of stood out was, did you notice about how Walt was saying in the beginning he was going to be going to a dedication for a Walter Disney elementary school? Well, I tell you what, a little while ago I had done a little research on that, and there are 14 different Walter Elias Disney elementary schools across the country. If you check the show notes of the show this week, I'll throw a link to a blog post I put together that has links to each of those elementary schools. It's pretty cool. The next clip kind of ties into that, in that this is Walt's visit to Marceline, Missouri. He went back in 1956 and had a couple great words and some thoughts for the crowds that gathered for his visit. Here it is.
We're on the air. They want me to say something. We're wasting film, I know. I can't think of what to say. Well, it's wonderful to be back. It's been a good many years. In fact, 50 years ago we came here. I was only 4.5 years old. My big brother, who took care of me and pushed me around in the baby buggy. Should I tell how old you were, Roy?
Well, I've got a lot of company here, Walt. You can't lie tonight now.
No secret now, huh?
No.
Well, we left here, I think we came here about 1906. And we left here about 1910. So anything that happened around here, I was only 9 and a half. You can't blame me. I know you can't use that on the air, Leonard. That'll have to be caught. But my big brother was in high school. Well, I did come back through here one time. Let's see, 1917 I came through on my way to Chicago. I don't know whether Roy's been back or if he dared come back. But it's always wonderful to have a hometown. You know, I feel sorry for people who live in cities all their lives and they don't have a little hometown. I do. Born in Chicago, and I'm glad that my dad picked out a little town where he could have a farm, because those 6 years that we spent here have been memorable years, and I think they've played a big part in some of the corny gags that I've put in the cartoons. I know in the early cartoons, I used to feature a little outhouse, and I know darn well I got that here in Marceline. The only other place I lived outside of Marceline was Kansas City, and that was a modern city. Everything was up to date in Kansas City. You know, we didn't have those outhouses. But it helped us in those early days. We got a lot of laughs with that outhouse. Of course, as we got a little more money to work with, why, we got a little more refined about it, and the outhouse had to go. But the town of Marceline has cropped up many times in things we've done. I mean, the the fun we had on the farm. I remember I was just young enough that I didn't have to do any heavy work. Roy had to do all the work, such as milking the cows and things like that. I used to tag along at his heels. And there's many things we did here that I'll never forget. Roy was always my big brother, and he always took care of me. He always saw that if anything come to town, that I had a dime or a nickel to go and spend it. And I remember one time he washed a hearse down here. He said, "Walt, we've got a job washing a hearse." So we went down to wash the hearse. Well, he did the work, and I played dead inside the hearse all day. So, after 50 years, it's wonderful to have so many friends here and everything, to have people here remember us. Passed the little theater down here where I remember seeing the first movie that I ever saw in my life. And should I tell about Mrs. Mormon?
Yeah.
Well, just before we left the farm, I was just about a little over 9 years old, and my folks took a little trip to St. Louis, and we were living in a house right next to where Mrs. Mormon lived here, right beyond that power plant. I know right where it is. My big brother was keeping me. It was just my brother and I there. But there was a basketball game being played somewhere, and Mr. Mormon took the team. My brother went with him, so he left me with Mrs. Mormon. So she said, "Are you scared to sleep alone?" I said, "Yes." And I said, I think there's something you don't know, that I was a pretty good hog rider. When we first had the farm out there, we were quite a while getting a good, a large enough hog pen. So when they wanted to let the hogs grub, they used to let them out loose, and I used to herd them to keep them. Then we'd put them back in the pen. We had a little pond. And I used to get on those old sows and grab them by the ear and ride them till they go right in the pond. My dad's quite Well, it was wonderful to be here. You've got enough. You can cut out of there, can't you?
Walt sounded really good in that visit. He really sounded like he was happy to be back. Some of the things I didn't realize was how little time they spent actually in Marceline. I think he was saying maybe it was like maybe 4 years, 3 years. Really, really good recording, though. The next thing we're going to listen to, we're going to flash ahead a little bit to 1964, and we're going to hear Walt talk about the World Fair project. Now, the World's Fair was being held in New York, and the Disney Company had done a lot of work for the World's Fair for a number of different companies. And it's kind of cool. We're going to hear Walt talk about that. And basically, everything they had done up till now had prepared the company for this next big step. So let's listen to Walt.
Nothing ever conceived by man has done more to give him a concise understanding, an encyclopedic picture of his achievements and projection of his future than the International World's Fair. His exhibits are the substance of his imagination, his dream of today, the reality of tomorrow. When the first visitors surge through the gates of the New York World's Fair on April 22nd this year, they will come face to face with the most awe-inspiring extravaganza ever conceived. This billion-dollar spectacle will be more dazzling, more educational, more fun, more astonishing than any World's Fair ever held. This is Dick Strout with World's Fair Report. We'll talk with a gentleman whose contribution to the fair is very much in evidence. His dominant role was inevitable, for he is a master showman. The man who created the world's largest tourist attraction, in itself a world's fair, Disneyland. Of course, that man is Mr. Walt Disney. It's a real pleasure, sir, to talk with you.
Well, nice to talk to you, Dick.
Under the banner of WED Enterprises, which incidentally stands for Walter Elias Disney, Mr. Disney has produced four major exhibits at the fair for Ford Motor Company, General Electric, and the state of Illinois. WED also designed a fourth exhibit, Pepsi-Cola, which was constructed and will be operated by Walt Disney Productions. What is WED Enterprises, Mr. Disney? Is this the same group of talented people that designed Disneyland?
Well, Wed is, you might call it my backyard laboratory, you know, my workshop away from work. It served a purpose in that some of the things I was planning, like Disneyland, for example, it was pretty hard for the banking mind to go with it. I had to go ahead on my own and develop it to a point where that they could begin to comprehend what I had in mind. So it's been true with a lot of things in our history here that we've been doing something that's a little bit out of the run of things, and it's pretty hard to sell people on what you have in your mind. So you have to go ahead and develop it. And that's what I've been doing with WED. I can do things at WED without asking anybody, even my wife. She's hard to sell lots of times.
Like space age development, many of your contributions have introduced new words to our vocabulary. Your most recent is audio animatronic. I hope I'm pronouncing
that right. It's, sound, animation through electronics. It's opened a whole new door for us. We can program whole shows on a tape. This little tape sends signals, and the little figures go to work, and they sing and act and move according to the impulse that comes from the tape. And this has all been possible because of this big drive that we've had on the space age development, the electronic age.
You're using audio animatronics for all four exhibits, like we mentioned before. What are some of the specific effects of each exhibit? How would you like each one to affect fair visitors?
They all tie in with the theme of the World's Fair. It's progress. Like the General Electric show, for example, we have what we call the Carousel of Progress. Now, it's a theater that revolves. The people revolve around six stages. And on each one of these stages are my audio animatronic figures that enact a little part of the whole story. And we start with the pre-electrical age. We had coal lamps and all that, coal oil lamps. And we go up to early electrical, mid-electric, and then up to today and what you can do with electricity in your home. But the audience itself revolves around these fixed stages. And it's called the Carousel Theater of Progress. And I want to tell you about my Pepsi-Cola show. This took a lot of imagineering, too. It's a tribute to the children of the world. And it's a little fantasy where you take a trip around the world of children in a boat. And you visit all the different countries with all the different children of these countries in their costumes. And then a lot of toy-like figures to represent other things. And these little figures dance and sing and finally end up with a big finale, which is like the finale in any musical, where all the children from these other lands that you've visited are all together in one, all singing in unison, and it's a big, spectacular finish. So it's called It's a Small World. With the Ford exhibit, we take them in a Ford product, and they ride back in time, and they go back to the primeval days with the big giant lizards, dinosaurs and brontosauruses and stegosauruses and all of that. And they're all animated and moving, very lifelike. They move from that up to the early age of man. Then we show how man was learning to better his way of life, where he learned how to use fire, where he learned to build weapons. And you'll meet for the first time the fellow who invented the wheel. He's a caveman. He's got this wheel, and he's trying to sell it to his neighbors, and he's having an awful hard time. You know, they don't believe the darn thing's worth anything, you know. Then we go into the fantasy of the world of tomorrow. In the Ford product, you ride right through, more or less like a skyway. And then we come back to today, and the Ford has a wonderful show of their product today and how it's designed and all of that. I think the Ford exhibit's going to be one of the top exhibits at the fair.
And then let's see, there's one other.
Oh, my Lincoln. I think that people are going to be surprised how lifelike this Abraham Lincoln is going to be when they're going to sit in there and listen to this great man who gives a speech on liberty. And these are the speeches taken from Abraham Lincoln's own writings and speeches. And he's in a very dignified setting. And the audience is conditioned. And then they're presented to the president, and he stands up and addresses this audience. Oh, by the way, on the Lincoln figure, we've done considerable research so that we really could create a lifelike impression of Lincoln. We're fortunate in being able to secure a life mask that was made of Lincoln. It was made in about 1860, I think. And it gave us a chance to know the real contour of his face and all of that. And then by research, we found all of his mannerisms. We selected a voice that fit the closest to what was described as Lincoln's voice, and also how he used to start his speech. He'd start it rather high, then as he got into his speech, he would come down and modulate his voice a little more carefully. He was a fellow who could get rather emotional in the middle of a speech, too. So we've done everything we can to create the most lifelike image of Lincoln, more so than I think any actor could ever do. It's a big fair. I think people are going to be surprised. It's really an exciting thing. I was there just a few weeks ago. It's going to be the biggest fair, I think, yet, without a doubt.
The New York World's Fair sounds like an experience of a lifetime, and I'm sure that no one who goes there is likely to forget it. Thank you so much, Walt Disney, for being our guest.
Thank you, Dick.
This is Dick Strout with World's Fair Report, returning you to our main studios.
That was a pretty cool interview. Walt had some awesome things to say. Now, think about that. The four designs they created for the World's Fair ended up going into Disney parks and surviving even up till now for the majority. The Carousel of Progress, of course, is still in Walt Disney World's Tomorrowland. The Small World attraction is in both parks and around the world. The Ford ride he kept mentioning, I think you would have thought that would be Horizons that ended up at Epcot and then is gone now. And then the Lincoln animatronic. Now, the actual animatronic of Lincoln can be seen in One Man's Dream, at least the last time I was there. And you can see another version of Lincoln in the Hall of Presidents, which is very cool. We also saw Lincoln in Disneyland. That was a very... You know, the show in Disneyland we saw was pretty cool in that it seemed to be the most authentic. That, to me, felt as if that was probably the World's Fair show that they just carted out to California when it was over and installed at Disneyland. I have to do a little research in that. Anyway, now the next clip is a short one, but it's going to be about animatronics again. And this was from the Disneyland TV show, so keep that in mind as you listen to it. It's going to open up with Walt talking to three baby dinosaurs. So here we go.
You know you're on television. You don't know about television, do you? Well, why don't you look pretty? That's it. Yeah, get your head up and hold it there now. Show them how you behave. That's it. How would you like to have one of these little dinosaurs for a pet? Actually, they're tame as a kitten, quite friendly. And they won't bite the hand that feeds them because they're strictly vegetarian. You know, scientists call these little creatures Brontosaurus. But we have named them Huey. Thank you, Huey. And Dewey. Now, Dewey, don't get bashful. Come on up. Get it up there. That. Thank you. And Louie. Hey, Louie. Hey, boy. Huh? Actually, baby dinosaurs would make great house pets. Of course, you'd have to have a very large house because creature like this would grow to be 90 feet long and 30 feet tall and weigh up to 60,000 pounds. Now, I suppose you're wondering what we're doing with dinosaurs here at the studio. Well, these baby brontosauruses are just a few of the hundreds of three-dimensional animated figures developed for the World's Fair. Although fairs are supposed to feature the newest thing, we went back over 100 million years these models. In a few minutes, we're going to take you backstage and show you how we created four special exhibits for the New York World's Fair, the greatest show on earth. This is what we call our Imagineering Department. It's where we dream up our new projects for Disneyland or World's Fair. You might be wondering how an animation studio like ours got into the World's Fair business. And frankly, I've often wondered about that myself. But we've been preparing for this international exposition for many years without realizing it. Little did we know when we dreamed up Mickey and Donald here that someday they would be the ancestors of the mammoth animated characters we've created for this fair, such as this Tyrannosaurus Rex here, the carnivorous lizard of prehistoric time.
The next two clips are a couple clips about one of our favorite topics, Walt Disney World. The first announcement from Walt in California about the Disney World project And you know, the first clip, it's going to sound actually like he's talking to stockholders. I'm not sure if the company was public at that point or not, but it is interesting to hear it. The second clip is basically, it sounds like it could have been the interview with the Florida governor, but Walt's talking about the money investment that's going to be going into Walt Disney World. So I thought that was interesting to hear too. So here we go.
Welcome to a little bit of Florida here in California. This is where the early planning is taking place for our so-called Disney World project. Now, the purpose of this film is to bring you up to date about some of the plans for Disney World. But before I go into any of the details, I want to say just a word about the site of our Florida project. As you can see on this map, we have a perfect location in Florida, almost in the very center of the state. In fact, we selected this site because it's so easy for tourists and Florida residents to get here by automobile. Now, in larger scale on this map, our Florida land is located partly in Orange County and Osceola County, between the cities of Orlando and Kissimmee. And the important thing is that the Disney World is located just a few miles from the crossing point of Interstate 4 and Sunshine State Parkway. Florida's major highways carrying motors east and west and north and south to the center of the state. The sketches and plans you will see today are simply a starting point, our first overall thinking about Disney World. Everything in this room may change time and time again as we move ahead. But the basic philosophy of what we're planning for Disney World is going to remain very much as it is right now. We know what our goals are. We know what we hope to accomplish. And believe me, it's the most exciting and challenging assignment we've ever tackled at Walt Disney Productions.
I don't think you've mentioned the amount of money as the initial investment. That's a heck of a lot. That would indicate the size of this project.
Well, there was a time in my life I didn't think there was that much money.
But, well, you see, the initial stage here has to top what we have, or at least be the equivalent of what we have now in California. And there's $54 million in Disneyland now, another $20 million this year. So we're going to have to start somewhere around there. Now, of course, that doesn't include the other facilities, the hotels and the things around it. Now, when you begin to put all those together, it's going to be well over $100 million plus, at least. But my big brother says we can do it. He's a money man.
The last clip we're going to play for this show is Walt talking about himself. Now, the story itself is pretty interesting, and it almost is a little bit, I don't want to say sad, but it definitely lets him look back at his 40 or so years with the company and what he's been able to do. He kind of, at the end of it, laments about how maybe his brother was better off being the mailman and such, but you know, it still leads me to question how he really thought about this. I got to think he was still very proud of the entire company and what has happened to it, but he is very wistful at the end about getting away to go fishing. So I'll let you guys decide. Here you go.
You know, I was stumped one day when a little boy asked, "Do you draw Mickey Mouse?" And I had to admit I do not draw anymore. Well, then you think of all the jokes and ideas. "No," I said, "I don't do that." Finally, he looked at me and said, "Mr. Disney, just what do you do?" Well, I said, "Sometimes I think of myself as a little bee. I go from one area of the studio to another and gather pollen and sort of stimulate everybody. I guess that's the job I do."
Well, after 40 some odd years in the business, my greatest reward, I think, is that I've been able to build this wonderful organization. Also to have the public appreciate and accept what I've done all these years. That is a great reward. But all individuals are different. Some of us just wouldn't be satisfied with just carrying out a routine job and being happy. Yet I envy those people. I had a brother who
who I really envied because he was a mailman. But he was the one that had all the fun. He had himself a trailer, and he used to go off and go fishing, and he didn't worry about payrolls and stories and picture grocers or anything. And he was the happy one. I always said he's the smart Disney.
He might have been the small Disney, Walt, but you know what? You're the Disney everybody loves. So that's it for today. What'd you guys think? Send me an email, ed@thedisneynerdspodcast.com, and let me know. We'll be doing this again probably in a couple months. And if you come across any quotes you've never heard before, you thought are exceptional, definitely send me an email. Let me know about it. I'm always interested in this. History is a big hobby of mine. And you know what? It kind of really, really adds to the entire Disney World process. So that's it for show number 225, Listening to Walt. We'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye, guys.
So hurry back, we would like your